He watches the young man with growing hatred. The love everyone has for him is unfair, he decides, misdirected. In his warped mind, a plan begins to develop, one in which he gets to lash out at the man who represents everything he is not, kind, loved, cherished. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 158, The Murder of Lindo Kuhle Mhele. This episode is sponsored by Ring. Ring offers a wide range of easy-to-install home security devices, including security cameras, video doorbells, and alarms. These are monitored on your phone via the Ring app. Ring will be running massive Home Security Week specials this month from the 22nd of July 2024 until the end of the month, where you can save up to 50% on selected Ring devices. Visit Takealot and Incredible Connection for more information on these deals. Available while stocks last. Ring. Keeping people close to what's important. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at True Crime South Africa /donate. Shout outs to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Ephraim Teboho, Moteo Mokaba, Ria Erasmus, Tanya Kowalski, Leone van der Heuwe, Pierre, Bulletproof Jill, Bree, and Lindsay Cabrita for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. Today's case can undoubtedly be termed a hate crime. It's a type of crime I became very familiar with in my research for my most recent book, Sizzlers, The Hate Crime That Tore Sea Point Apart. Although all murders are undoubtedly pointless, hate-driven murders, those committed simply on the basis of the victim's race, religion, sexuality, or other aspect of them, which really shouldn't result in their death, are, to me at least, particularly unnecessary. It must take an awful lot of rage, and maybe even some self-hatred to some extent, to believe that other people are less than you and deserve to die. My sources for this case include an episode of Emmy Buzo, which is available on Showmax, an episode of Cutting Edge, which is available on YouTube, and several media and social media articles. So, let's get into episode 158, the murder of Linda Kuchle Mele.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Linda Kuchle Mele was born and raised in Umlazi in KwaZulu-Natal. Umlazi as an area was declared a township in 1962. Today it is the fourth largest township in South Africa and the largest in KZN. The official census numbers as at 2011 put residents at 400,000. But it's believed with the informal settlements that have sprung up in and around Umlazi, that number could be closer to 1 million residents. Linda Kuchle's grandmother says that he became an orphan at an early age. No more information is provided about how his parents passed away, but Lindo, as he was affectionately called, was embraced by his extended family, and his aunt and uncle raised him. They refer to him as their son, and it's clear in the deep grief they express in documentaries and to journalists that they did indeed see Linda Kuchle as their own child. Lindo's grandmother, aunt, and uncle also all explain that there was never really a coming out for Linda Kuchle as a gay man. They knew very well that Lindo was gay, even from before he would be old enough to express attraction to others, and no one in his family had any issue with that. A spokesperson for the Utingo Network, a KZN-based human rights organization that advocates for the rights of LGBTQ persons with a specific focus on rural communities, says that in their experience, this is not always the case in black communities, especially in KZN. According to the spokesperson, both the cultural and religious aspects of the province make homophobia rife, especially in rural areas. Although Lindo would undoubtedly have experienced homophobia during his life, whether from those in his community or just out in the world in general, he seemed to have a really strong base of support at home, with his friends and family. There was something else Lindo's family had always known about him from when he was a child. He was a born performer and an incredible singer. So in 2015, he began to attend the South African School of Motion Picture Medium and Live Performance called AFTA. And there he truly found community. He found people like him who were for the most part creative, open to all ways of living life, and inclusive. And in Lindo, his fellow students found someone who was caring, full of life, and would never back down when someone else was being bullied or belittled. Lindo was described as an activist for LGBTQ rights, and even those students who were not part of the queer community recalled that he inspired them to be confident, take up space within the world, and be proud of who they were. By 2019, Lindo was making a name for himself as a musician. He was being noticed and performing under the name Lindo C, S-E-A. He released several singles, which were incredibly popular. As any artist will tell you, including writers, there's very little actual money in creating art, unless you really crack the big time. And even then, you can't just rest on your laurels and think that one song or book or painting is going to do it. As much as there's a creative process, there's also got to be regular creation. Otherwise, it's just a hobby. Either way, in the beginning, for most people in the arts, other jobs are absolutely necessary to get off the ground. Lindo was in discussions for a recording contract, and toward the end of 2019, he also secured a job he would start in March 2020. His grandmother said he'd been talking about how much easier things were going to be at home when he was bringing in a salary. That New Year's Eve, Lindo Kuchle spent the night at a female friend's house where they had a small party to welcome in the new year with a few other friends. One of the friends had invited a man who lived in the area called Mvuyisi Moguda. At 30 years old, Mvuyisi was quite a bit older than the rest of the crowd. But this wasn't the only reason he didn't really fit in that night. Many of the people at the party, including Lindo's female friend and other women, felt uncomfortable at his presence, because many women in the area had allegedly accused him of rape and attempted rape. It doesn't seem that any of these instances had led to any charges or arrests, but that should also not be surprising in a country where it's estimated that only 1 in 36 rapes is reported. The man very simply just gave off creepy vibes to the woman, and no one felt very happy that he was there, but did their best to still have a good New Year's Eve despite it. Most of the crowd, including Mvuyisi, slept over at Lindo's friend's house that night. I refer to her as Lindo's friend and not by her name, as her identity was withheld in most of the reporting I saw. On the morning of the 1st of January 2020, everyone had a slow start, and by the early afternoon, most of the crowd had left. But Lindo had remained behind, and Mvuyisi just didn't seem to get the message that it was time for him to leave. At one point, Lindo's friend found herself alone with Mvuyisi because Lindo had gone for a nap. She felt so uncomfortable that she'd gone into the bedroom and woke Lindo up, asking him if they could leave and go for a walk, in the hopes that Mvuyisi would have left by the time they returned. Lindo agreed and got up. He needed to use the toilet before they left, and told his friend to stay in the room until he came back. Lindo's friend started to get worried after a while, because he was taking far longer than expected. When he eventually returned, he seemed flustered, and told his friend that he could see why women were afraid of Mvuyisi. He told her that Mvuyisi had cornered him on his way back from the toilet and offered him money and cigarettes to leave him alone with his female friend. The implication of what might happen if Lindo went along with this seemed clear to both, and they left the house as quickly as possible. Thankfully, when the pair returned from their walk, Mvuyisi was gone. But it wasn't the last time they'd hear from him. In the weeks that followed, rumours began circulating that Mvuyisi was bad-mouthing Lindo Kuchle in the community. Much of this would only surface when it was too late, but it seemed clear that the man had developed a deep hatred for Lindo. He said to friends that he'd never seen a man so beautiful in appearance, who was loved by so many. He told people that he'd like to scar Lindo's face, and even mentioned wanting to paralyze him and see how beautiful he looked in a wheelchair. His insults, threats, and slurs were clearly homophobic. People would later say that Mvuyisi seemed to hate Lindo simply because he was gay, which he deemed wrong. And so many people still loved him. Lindo's confidence and charisma threatened Mvuyisi. And as Lindo went on with his life, preparing for his new job to start in March, none of this made its way to his ears. On the morning of the 6th of February, Lindo Kuchle woke up feeling unwell. He told his grandmother, who suggested he have something to eat and take some pain medication. He did so and went back to sleep for a while. When he woke, he saw that they'd run out of electricity and offered to walk to the shop, buy prepaid electricity, and he planned to buy a takeaway meal for himself and his friend. His friend would later explain how they'd taken a slow walk up to the shop and when they arrived ordered their meals and waited for the keeper of the informal shop to make them. Within a few minutes, a taxi pulled up, and a few people got out. Lindo's friend noticed that one of those people was Mvuyisi Mogudu. The man walked up to the shop owner and asked if they had any dacha for sale. The shopkeeper went to look, and while Mvuyisi was waiting, he turned, looking around, and spotted Lindor and his friend. Within seconds, he was upon them. Pulling a knife out of his jacket, without warning, he grabbed Lindor Kuchle's hair and attacked him, first stabbing him in his back, and then on the front of his upper body, his chest, neck, and face. The corner where the store was a busy spot, and crowds of people stood around. Lindor's friend, despite being in shock, did what she could to help, but Mvuyisi was manic. None of the other people standing around attempted to help. Lindor begged for mercy as the man stabbed at him. Finally, Mvuyisi seemed satisfied that he'd inflicted as much damage as he wanted to, and he fled the scene, leaving the knife lodged in Lindor Kuchle's eye. Lindor's friend ran off to his house to inform his family, and within a few minutes they had him loaded into a car and on the way to the hospital. He was losing so much blood that there was simply no way they were going to chance waiting for an ambulance. Lindor's friend sat in the back seat with him and tried to comfort him. Despite the blood loss, he remained conscious. He told his friend that he couldn't feel his arms or legs and asked if she would rub them for him. She did so, tentatively, hoping she wasn't making things worse by doing this. When they arrived at the hospital, Lindor was rushed away and his friend was left waiting. The shock and acknowledgement of what had happened settling in as more of Lindor's family members arrived. Lindor Kuchle Qele arrived at the Prince George Hospital just after 5 p.m. that day. For 4 hours, doctors did everything they could to stabilize Lindor, enough to take him into surgery and remove the knife from his eye. Lindor was given 2 pints of blood, but every time his blood pressure seemed to be stabilizing, doctors discovered yet another stab wound that was bleeding out. The doctor would later tell Lindor's family that he was one of the strongest young men he'd ever had as a patient. Despite the trauma his body had undergone, and even as his heart struggled to continue pushing blood to all his organs, he remained conscious throughout the ordeal. Finally, near 9 p.m. that night, the doctor said Lindor began attempting to pull the knife out of his eye. The doctor gently pushed his hand down, explaining to him that they would remove it in surgery as soon as he was stable enough. They first had to assess what would happen when the blade was removed. The doctor said Lindor looked him straight in the eye and said softly, "I'm going to die anyway. I don't want to die with this in my eye." Then Lindor took his last breath, and his heart stopped beating. The 23-year-old, with so much promise and so much life left to live, had his future snatched away from him, and his killer was on the run. Around midnight, the news of Lindor's murder began to hit social media, and many of his fellow students at AFTA and his friends found out about his death that way. Although Mvuyisi Moguda did attempt to flee, his name was quickly given over to police as the perpetrator, and he was located and placed under arrest soon after. Pictures of him from his early appearances in court show his hand bandaged up. There's no confirmation of this, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if this was from his own hand getting cut up as they became slippery with Lindor's blood and slid over the knife blade. Although Mvuyisi did not deny that he'd stabbed Lindor Kuchle, he did indicate his intention to plead not guilty to the charge of murder. In a shocking claim that came completely out of left field, Mvuyisi said in his plea statement that he'd killed Lindor in a fit of rage after he'd been told that Lindor had drugged and raped him at the New Year's Eve party. Mvuyisi claimed he hadn't realized anything untoward had happened that night until one of the other partygoers, a friend of his, had told him Lindor had done this. None of Lindor's friends or family believed this to be true, but Mvuyisi seemed intent on using this as a defense, with the assertion that he'd been overcome by rage and hadn't been in control of himself on the day the murder had occurred. Of course, just a month after Lindor was murdered, the COVID-19 pandemic escalated to the point where South Africa was locked down and the judicial service was severely impacted. As a result, it would take some time for this case to come to trial. In the meantime, Lindor was laid to rest in a funeral that was both beautiful and devastating. Many of his fellow AFDA students, with their stunning, soaring voices, sang to their slain friend's memory. From videos of the event, the grief is deep and palpable. His aunt, the woman who had raised him and called him her son, said that Lindor's death was a symptom of a world who accepted gay people on the surface, but still seethed against them underneath. She hinted at the irony that a stranger, someone who Lindor's life did not affect at all, should be the one who so deeply despised him for his sexuality, when his family, his friends, and his fellow students had never done anything but love him. Lindor's sexuality should have been of absolutely no consequence to this man who only lived in the same community as him, and yet his hatred had been so deep that he hadn't just stabbed at him, but the autopsy would show he'd ripped the knife down through Lindor's skin, causing horrible, gaping injuries. In all, Lindor had been stabbed more than 21 times, and at least 18 of those injuries would have been fatal on their own. The rape allegation from the perpetrator is a tricky one. I fully believe that anyone who claims to have experienced sexual assault of any kind should be supported and given space to heal. But there are aspects here that just don't fit. By the time the trial eventually started, Mvuyisi's story around the rape had changed, and he said that no one had actually said Lindor had raped him, but he was told he had been raped by someone at the party, and through a process of elimination, he himself had come to the conclusion that Lindor was the only gay man there, so he had to have done it. If Mvuyisi was raped by anyone at that party, it would be a horrible thing. But for him to have concluded that the person must have been Lindor simply because he was the only openly gay man there is ludicrous. Plus, it didn't even have to be a gay man that did it, because rape is not about sex or sexual attraction, it's about power. Heterosexual men do rape other men. It happens. Honestly, though, the evidence that there was never a rape and that actually Mvuyisi just hated Lindor for his own reasons was far greater. Mvuyisi, after all, according to Lindor's friend, was a known sexual predator himself. He had tried to bribe Lindor into leaving his friend alone with him, and Lindor had refused. And although homophobia is an illogical hatred, powerful enough on its own for him to have committed this crime, I think the fact that Lindor refused to allow him access to assault his friend just added fuel to Mvuyisi's fire. Mvuyisi never did produce the friend he claimed had told him he'd been raped as a witness in his defense. None of the psychological evidence pointed toward Mvuyisi having experienced any sort of mental break that would have meant he was not responsible for his actions. But the prosecutor was also not able to prove that the murder was premeditated, despite the evidence that Mvuyisi had spoken about wanting to harm Lindor. And so, upon being found guilty, Mvuyisi Moguda was handed down a determinate sentence of 25 years. Although I was not able to get my hands on the sentencing document for this case, I haven't found any mention made of a specified non-parole period, which means that Mvuyisi Moguda may well become eligible for parole after serving 12 and a half years of his sentence. And although the 25-year sentence is in line with what we've seen in other non-premeditated murders, I really feel that the hate crime aspect of this should have attracted a longer sentence. At the very least, I hope that when Moguda becomes eligible for parole, his risk for continued violent homophobia is properly assessed. As far as I'm concerned, illogical hatred like this takes a lot of therapy and a lot of hard work from the individual to rehabilitate. And I really don't know whether this man is a great candidate for that. For all people in the South African queer community and those who love anyone who identifies within the LGBTQ community, I certainly hope he is carefully considered before being released. 4 years after Lindor Kukle's murder, his legacy lives on in those who loved him. His friends regularly post about him on social media, their way perhaps of staying connected. And if you search the hashtag #JusticeForLindor with the number 4, you'll find several heart-wrenching posts about how deeply this young man touched the lives of so many. The Human Rights Commission posted an article on their website about Lindor Kukle's murder in the wake of his murderer's sentencing. In it, they make 2 very important points. The first is that the murderer felt empowered enough to commit this murder in broad daylight in front of many witnesses. That empowerment came from somewhere. Why did he feel so comfortable doing so? And why did no one intervene? The second point they make is about all the things that Lindor's murderer said about him and the threats he made in the run-up to his murder. Many of these statements were blatant hate speech. They demeaned a man on the basis of his sexuality, and not only did he feel comfortable saying these things, but he was never taken up on it by anyone. No one said to Mvuyisi, "What you are saying is deplorable. It's homophobic. And not just that, it's criminal." I'd actually like to quote directly from that article here because I think it perfectly expresses the point. Quote, "His homophobic statements and sentiments were not confronted. Did anyone tell Moguda that his sentiments and comments were inappropriate? Did people tell him that his homophobic statements constituted hate speech and violated Lindor Kukle's right to dignity and equality, let alone the rights of other gay men and lesbians? Inaction and allowing a culture of discrimination can lead to violence and death. Ongoing hate speech, whether in person, among people or on social media that is directed at vulnerable groups, can lead to violence and death. Perpetrators of hate speech, if not confronted, could develop a sense of impunity. Why would a perpetrator feel any sense of concern, knowing full well that people are too fearful of confronting his hate speech, or that they may share his sentiments? When hate speech evolves into hate crimes, such as murder, the perpetrator may even believe that he is acting on behalf of a group of people, that he is able to do what others only dream of, but lack the courage to execute. In this instance, our communal silence goes beyond consent. it could be interpreted as an endorsement of hatred and violence. End quote. I consider myself an ally to the LGBTQ community. I did long before I started learning and writing and podcasting about hate crimes. But even I sometimes pick my battles. And I know a lot of other people do too. Sometimes we'll hear someone say something or see something blatantly homophobic on social media, and instead of saying something, it feels easier to not get involved. If I see homophobic content anywhere in my social media feeds, I immediately take action to get it out of my feed. But just because I'm not seeing it anymore doesn't mean it doesn't exist, and it's not still causing harm. Or we'll be seated around a family dinner table, and someone will say something, again, blatantly homophobic, and it just feels like it's not the right time to stand against it. Sure, we can't fight every battle there is to fight, and we can't spend our entire lives raging against illogical hatred. But if, as the Human Rights Commission article says, our communal silence goes beyond consent, and it could be interpreted as an endorsement of hatred or even violence, the peace we may be trying to keep is far too costly. For 23-year-old Lindo Kuchle-Knele, the cost was his life. Lindo Kuchle-Knele, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.